Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist for Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to this, the latest edition of the Gist of Freedom. As always, we try to bring you the biggest and the latest news that is impacting the world and the African-American community. We wanted to give you this interruption in our regularly broadcasted segment to let you know, if you haven't heard of already, about the resignation of United States Attorney General Eric Holder. Now, we wanted to bring this to you because of the significance of this and what Eric Holder means to the Obama administration and what it will mean moving forward. For those of you who do not know, Eric Hempton Holder Jr. was born January 21st, 1951, and that was in the borough of the Bronx in the greatest city in the world, New York City. He is married to Sharon Malone and has three children. But he is the 82nd Attorney General of the United States. Been in office since 2009, one of the very few cabinet members of President Obama's to be serving this long. One of them is Tom Vilsack, and the other, of course, Arne Duncan, who is the United States Secretary of Education. The only three of them have been serving the longest in President Obama's since he assumed office in 2008. Now, Holder serving in the administration is the first black African-American to hold the position of United States Attorney General in its entire history. He previously served as a judge of the Superior Court of the District of Columbia and as a United States Attorney. While a U.S. Attorney, he prosecuted Congressman Dan Rosenkowski of Illinois for corruption charges related to his role and the Congressional Post Office scandal. Later, he was Deputy Attorney General of the United States and worked at the law firm of Covington and Burling in Washington, D.C. He was senior legal advisor to President Obama during Obama's president campaign and one of three members of Obama's vice presidential selection committee. This guy was instrumental in choosing the current vice president now as his running mate, Joe Biden, of course. As a result of his refusal to meet the documentation demands of the Fast and Furious investigation, he became the only cabinet member in United States history to be held in contempt of Congress. Now, if you remember, this was a big to-do, the whole Fast and Furious investigation. If you don't know about the scandal, we will brief you on it very, very briefly, but we want you to go to the Internet. Please research this stuff because we don't want this to all be about you and about us informing you. We want you to educate yourselves. Now, the Fast and Furious, this was known as a tactic in the Arizona field office of the United States Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, ATF, which ran a series of sting operations between 2006 and 2011 in Tucson and Phoenix, where the ATF purposely allowed licensed firearm dealers to sell weapons to illegal strong buyers. Now, this investigation was huge. And because Eric Holder, the Attorney General, refused to hand over information and cooperate, he was held in contempt of Congress. That was a big black eye in his administration as the U.S. Attorney General. Moving on. As of late, Holder has been instrumental in defending President Obama against illegal attacks, against the allegations that he's not a citizen. He has been steadfast aside the president when it comes to issues of civil rights. If you remember, he has really taken a very public stance alongside people like Reverend Al Sharpton, coming out about stop and frisk and Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown. He has been a leading voice for trying to use the Justice Department's scope, legally, whatever they can do, to go after people who have been doing wrong within the United States of America. On September 25th of this year, hours after a federal judge denied the Department of Justice's request to further delay the release of Fast and Furious documents, the Justice Department said that Holder would resign as soon as his successor is confirmed. Now, this is important to note. I'm going to say it again. On September 25th, today, hours, this is just hours immediately following a federal judge's denial of the Department of Justice's request to further delay the release of Fast and Furious documents. That same case that has been a black eye and abuse for the administration and for Eric Holder. They wanted to continue to delay the release of those documents relating to Fast and Furious case. This is what brought down his administration. It's important to know this, okay? You want to be informed people about African-American history, but you want to be understanding. No one, as a sitting United States Attorney General, just resigned, spend time with his family. Don't believe the hype. Now, I'm not telling you that Eric Holder is criminally negligent in any of his actions. I'm not saying that there is a conspiracy to cover up information. But because of a political investigation opened up by the United States Congress into what happened in the Fast and Furious case and the attempt that was denied on the Justice Department's hand to try and delay the release of information, hours after they announced that Eric Holder would resign as soon as his successor is confirmed. Now, one can speculate politically that there is something in those documents that Eric Holder did not want to have released, that his department acted in some kind of inappropriate way with relating to the Fast and Furious case in Arizona. I'm not saying that it was. I'm just saying that it looks kind of fishy and suspicious that after the judge said, we are not going to delay this case any further, that he announces that he is going to resign from his post as the United States Secretary of Education. Now, we're going to play the clip, Eric Holder's resignation. We're not going to do that just yet. But what I want to do is give you a synopsis of Eric Holder's life, his career, his legal profession, and his time up until now, because we want you to get a full sense of who Eric Holder was. Then we will talk about possible successors to Eric Holder, what challenges they will face, if they are to be confirmed. There's only a handful of people who are high-profile enough that they meet the criteria to succeed Eric Holder as the United States Attorney General. There is a lot of political pundits, if you've been reading the wires today on the Internet, they've been saying that President Obama would like to choose a successor to Eric Holder as someone that he is personally close with. There are only a handful of people to choose from. And there is speculation that Eric Holder lasted as long as he did because of his relationship to President Obama. I think there is some truth in that statement. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about his early life. Born in the Bronx, his parents had roots in Barbados, the old-fashioned Caribbean. This is very, very important to note. His father was born in St. Joseph, Barbados, and arrived in the United States at 11 years old. This is a family of immigrants. This is not a person who grew up in a very wealthy family and did not understand the nature of hard work. His father later became a real estate broker. His mother was born in New Jersey. And while his paternal parents were immigrants, he grew up in Queens. It's very important to note this. He attended public schools until the age of 10. Then at fourth grade, he was selected to participate in a program for intellectually gifted students. This was someone who believed and education, presumably because of his Caribbean ancestry. In 1969, he graduated from Stuyvesant High School in Manhattan, one of the regarded public schools in the city, and attended Columbia University. He played basketball, the first-year student, and was co-captain of his team. After that, he went to Columbia Law School, graduating in 76, and worked for the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund in his semester as an attorney general during his second semester. This is a man who took his law degree and didn't immediately go work in a private firm and made $150,000 a year. He went to work for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Very, very noble man. This is critically important to note. After he graduated law school, he joined the Justice Department, the Public Integrity Section. That time there lasted for about 4 years, and when he had an opportunity to prosecute some Congress members for bribery and corruption scandals, he was appointed by Ronald Reagan, a Republican, to serve as a judge of the Superior Court of the District of Columbia. A very accomplished jurist. He stepped down from the bench to accept an appointment as the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia from President Bill Clinton in 1993, when Bill Clinton assumed office. First black American U.S. attorney in that office. Still breaking down racial barriers. At the beginning of his tenure, he oversaw the conclusion of the corruption case that he started against Dan Rosenthalsky, part of the Congressional Post Office scandal. Now, for many of you who say, well, what is the Congressional Post Office scandal? Well, we're going to inform you because that's what we do here at the Gifts of Freedom. The Post Office scandal refers to the discovery of corruption among various postal workers, employees, and members of the United States House of Representatives. They were investigated for a period of 4 years between 1991 and 1995. It climaxed in the conviction of House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dan Rosenthalsky. This was one of the most powerful Democratic members of the United States House of Representatives. And it concluded in his conviction, not his indictment, not his in his accusal, but in his conviction. He was actually accused after the trial of wrongdoing by the judge. It was an initial investigation into a single embezzlement charge against a single employee. One employee brought down the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. Then a new investigation started after members of Congress wanted to shut down the inquiry, and then eventually led to the Speaker of the House being involved. Then there were reports that embezzlement and money laundering leaked out, and that's when all hell broke loose. At the end of this case, United States President Bill Clinton pardoned Dan Rosenthalsky in 2000. Eric Holder, who prosecuted the case and led to his conviction of that Congress member, when Bill Clinton got elected, he pardoned that same congressperson and appointed Eric Holder to the bench. Ain't that something? You couldn't make this stuff up if you tried, folks. Then in 1997, after the retirement of another judge, Bill Clinton, that same president who nominated Eric Holder for a previous jurist position and pardoned one of his convictees, appointed Holder, maybe because he knew where the bodies were buried, to the Deputy Attorney General under Janet Reno. You remember Janet Reno, right? May God her rest her soul in peace. Holder was confirmed several months later in the Senate by unanimous vote. During that confirmation hearing, his opposition to the death penalty was questioned, and he pledged his intention to cooperate with the current law in Reno, saying, quote, I am not a proponent of the death penalty, but I will enforce the law as this Congress gives it to us, end quote. He also became the first African-American to serve in that position, Deputy Attorney General. Along the way in his career, continually breaking barriers within the legal profession. And as the Deputy Attorney General, his primary responsibilities were about budget and personnel issues. Isn't that something? Always understanding how to accept the responsibility that he was given under his roles. He also went into private practice in 2001, became the Attorney General. He worked as an attorney at Covington & Burling in Washington, D.C., representing clients such as Merck and the National Football League, representing the NFL during the dogfighting investigation against Michael Vick. You remember Michael Vick. He's running around now trying to portray himself as a changed man. In 2004, Holder helped negotiate an agreement with the Justice Department for Chiquita Brands International in a case that involved Chiquita's payment of protection money to the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, a group on the United Government's list of terrorist organizations. We won't go too much into that case, but you can also do your due diligence there. In late 2007, Holder joined then Senator Barack Obama's presidential campaign as a senior legal advisor. He served on Obama's Vice Presidential Election Committee, as I mentioned, who eventually chose Joe Biden, who given to Dax every chance that he gets. That nomination then as the United States Attorney General was not that surprising. It was fairly understood. In 2008, when President Obama announced that he would be the nominee, he praised his toughness and independence. He went on to say that Eric Holder is deeply familiar with the law and the challenges we face, of course, by his long history. But what is going on now with Fast and Furious? I don't want to know how this is all going to play out. It was the war on terrorism, the war on civil rights, the voting rights, and redistricting. He has played a huge part, Eric Holder, and a proponent of the Federal Voter Rights Act of 1965. It was reauthorized in 2006, if you don't remember, with bipartisan support. Holder has been vocal in criticizing the new voter ID laws in Texas, Florida, and other states, which he suggests may be politically motivated. 2011, Holder said, quote, "The reality is that in jurisdictions across the country, both overt and subtle forms of discrimination remain all too common," end quote. He further went on to say that to criticize the Texas redistricting efforts, where the state had increased its population by 4 million people, most of whom are Latino, but the state had not allocated any new congressional seats to represent Hispanic voters. Isn't that something? There was a disproportionate amount of Hispanics who entered the state of Texas. But even with the census data going to reflect those numbers, no new congressional lines were reported to reflect the African-American Latinos in the district. There's something wrong. In a speech before the NAACP in 2012, this was very important because he went on to talk about how important it was to protect human rights and civil rights wherever he could. He was out against Arizona SB 1070, same-sex marriage, crime prosecutions. This is a man who has always believed in race relations. He has been involved in Operation Turquoise. And so far has been on the positive side of history, teaming up with people like Reverend Al Sharpton. Now, what I want to do now is go to this clip, because I want you all to hear, for your own words, the resignation of Eric Holder. I think it's important for you to hear it, analyze it, dissect it, digest it. Go to the clip now, please.
We're about to see the president comment here on the resignation of Eric Holder. Let's go to the president live at the White House.
On this generation of Americans falls the full burden of proving to the world that we really mean it when we say all men are created free and equal before the law. As one of the longest-serving attorney generals in American history, Eric Holder has borne that burden. And over the summer, he came to me and he said he thought 6 years was a pretty good run. I imagine his family agrees. Like me, Eric married up. He and his wife, Dr. Sharon Malone, a nationally renowned OB-GYN, have been great friends to Michelle and me for years. And I know Brooke and Maya and Buddy are excited to get their dad back for a while. So this is bittersweet. But with his typical dedication, Eric has agreed to stay on as Attorney General until I nominate his successor. And that successor is confirmed by the Senate, which means he'll have a chance to add to a proud career of public service, one that began nearly 40 years ago as a young prosecutor in the department that he now runs. He was there for 12 years, taking on political corruption until President Reagan named him to the bench as a judge. Later, President Clinton called him back. So all told, Eric has served at the Justice Department under six presidents of both parties, including a several-day stint as acting attorney general at the start of George W. Bush's first term. And through it all, he's shown a deep and abiding fidelity to one of our most cherished ideals as a people, and that is equal justice under the law. As younger men, Eric and I both studied law, and I chose him to serve as Attorney General because He believes, as I do, that justice is not just an abstract theory. It's a living and breathing principle. It's about how our laws interact with our daily lives. It's about whether we can make an honest living, whether we can provide for our families, whether we feel safe in our own communities and welcomed in our own country, whether the words that the founders set to paper 238 years ago apply to every single one of us and not just some. That's why I made him America's lawyer, the people's lawyer. That comes with a big portfolio, from counterterrorism to civil rights, public corruption to white-collar crime, and alongside the incredible men and women of the Justice Department, men and women that I promise you he is proud of and will deeply miss, Eric has done a superb job. He's worked side-by-side with our intelligence community and the Department of Homeland Security to keep us safe from terrorist attacks and to counter violent extremism. On his watch, federal courts have successfully prosecuted hundreds of terror cases, proving that the world's finest justice system is fully capable of delivering justice for the world's most wanted terrorists. He's rooted out corruption and fought violent crime. Under his watch, a few years ago, the FBI successfully carried out the largest mafia takedown in American history. He's worked closely with state and local law enforcement officers to make sure that they've got the resources to get the job done. And he's managed funds under the Recovery Act to make sure that when budgets took a hit, thousands of cops were able to stay on the beat nationwide. He's helped safeguard our markets from manipulation and consumers from financial fraud. Since 2009, the Justice Department has brought more than 60 cases against financial institutions and won some of the largest settlements in history for practices related to the financial crisis, recovering $85 billion, much of it returned to ordinary Americans who were badly hurt. He's worked passionately to make sure our criminal justice system remains the best in the world. He knows that too many outdated policies, no matter how well-intentioned, perpetuate a destructive cycle in too many communities. So Eric addressed unfair sentencing disparities, reworked mandatory minimums, and promoted alternatives to incarceration. And thanks to his efforts, since I took office, the overall crime rate and the overall incarceration rate have gone down by about 10%. That's the first time that they've declined together at the same time in more than 40 years. Eric's proudest achievement, though, might be reinvigorating and restoring the core mission to what he calls the conscience of the building, and that's the Civil Rights Division. He has been relentless against attacks on the Voting Rights Act, because no citizen, including our service members, should have to jump through hoops to exercise their most fundamental right. He's challenged discriminatory state immigration laws that not only risked harassment of citizens and legal immigrants, but actually made it harder for law enforcement to do its job. Under his watch, the department has brought a record number of prosecutions for human trafficking and for hate crimes, because no one in America should be afraid to walk down the street because of the color of their skin, the love in their heart, the faith they practice, or the disabilities that they live with. He's dramatically advanced the cause of justice for Native Americans, working closely with their communities. And several years ago, he recommended that our government stop defending the Defense of Marriage Act, a decision that was vindicated by the Supreme Court and opened the door to federal recognition of same-sex marriage and federal benefits for same-sex couples. It's a pretty good track record. Eric's father was an immigrant who served in the Army in World War II, only to be refused service at lunch counters in the nation he defended. But he and his wife raised their son to believe that this country's promise was real. And that son grew up to become Attorney General of the United States. And that's something. And that's why Eric's worked so hard, not just in my administration, but for decades, to open up the promise of this country to more striving, dreaming kids like him. To make sure that those words, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, are made real for all of us. So soon, Eric, Sharon, and their kids will be a bit freer to pursue a little more happiness of their own, and thanks to Eric's efforts, so will more Americans, regardless of race or religion, gender or creed, sexual orientation or disability, who will receive fair and equal treatment under the law. So I just want to say thank you, Eric. Thank you to the men and the women of the Justice Department who work day in and out for the American people, and we could not be more grateful for everything that you've done, not just for me and the administration, but for our country.
I come to this moment with very mixed emotions. Proud of what the men and women of the Department of Justice have accomplished over the last 6 years, and at the same time, very sad that I will not be a formal part of the great things that this department and this president will accomplish over the next two. I want to thank you, Mr. President, for the opportunity that you gave me to serve and for giving me the greatest honor of my professional life. We have been great colleagues, but the bonds between us are much deeper than that. In good times and in bad, in things personal and in things professional, you have been there for me. I'm proud to call you my friend. I'm also grateful for the support you have given me and the department, and we have made real the visions that you and I have always shared. I often think of those early talks between us about our belief that we might help to craft a more perfect union. Now, work remains to be done, but our list of accomplishments is real. Over the last 6 years, our administration, your administration, has made historic gains in realizing the principles of the founding documents and fought to protect the most sacred of American rights, the right to vote. We have begun to realize the promise of equality for our LGBT brothers and sisters and their families. We have begun to significantly reform our criminal justice system and reconnect those who bravely serve in law enforcement with the communities that they protect. We have kept faith with our belief in the power of the greatest judicial system the world has ever known to fairly and effectively adjudicate any cases that are brought before it, including those that involve the security of the nation that we both love so dearly. We have taken steps to protect the environment and make more fair the rules by which our commercial enterprises operate. And we have held accountable those who would harm the American people either through violent means or the misuse of economic or political power. I have loved the Department of Justice ever since as a young boy. I watched Robert Kennedy proved during the civil rights movement how the department can and must always be a force for that which is right. I hope that I have done honor to the faith that you have placed in me, Mr. President, and to the legacy of all those who have served before me. I would also like to thank the Vice President, who I have known for so many years and in whom I have found great wisdom, unwavering support, and a shared vision of what America can and should be. I want to recognize my good friend, Valerie Jarrett, whom I've been fortunate to work with from the beginning of what started as an improbable, idealistic effort by a young senator from Illinois, who we were both right to believe would achieve greatness. I've had the opportunity to serve in your distinguished cabinet and worked with a White House chief of staff, White House staff ably led by Dennis McDonough, that has done much to make real the promise of our democracy. And each of the men and women who I have come to know will be lifelong friends. Whatever my accomplishments, they could not have been achieved without the love, support, and guidance of two people who are not here with me today. My parents, Eric and Miriam Holder, nurtured me and my accomplished brother William and made us believe in the value of individual effort and the greatness of this nation. My time in public service, which now comes to an end, would not have been possible without the sacrifices, too often unfair, made by the best three kids a father could ask for. Thank you, Maya. Thank you, Brooke. And thank you, Buddy. And finally, I want to thank the woman who sacrificed the most and allowed me to follow my dreams. She's the foundation of all that our family is and the basis of all that I have become. My wife, Sharon, is the unsung hero, and she is my life partner. Thank you for all that you have done. I love you. In the months ahead, I will leave the Department of Justice, but I will never leave the work. I will continue to serve and try to find ways to make our nation even more true to its founding ideals. I want to thank the dedicated public servants who form the backbone of the United States Department of Justice for their tireless work over the past 6 years, for the efforts they will continue, and for the progress that they made and that will outlast us all. And I want to thank you all for joining me on a journey that now moves in another direction, but that will always be guided by the pursuit of justice and aimed at the North Star. Thank you.
Okay, so that was the United States Attorney General and President Obama in what was a very long, long, long clip. First, the reaction of President Obama to the resignation of Eric Holder, and then Eric Holder's talk on his resignation. Now, the question is, who is going to succeed Eric Holder? Here are some potential choices. Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, close friend of Obama. Patrick is not running for re-election in November. He's being long mentioned as a possible replacement. Patrick was the Chief of Justice for the Department of Civil Rights under Bill Clinton as governor. Patrick won raves for his handling of the Boston Marathon bombing and its aftermath. He said on Thursday that the Attorney General is, quote, an enormously important job, but it's not one for me right now. He denied that he is interested in the role. Donald Borelli, currently the U.S. Solicitor General, arguing the administration's legal positions before the Supreme Court. Kamala Harris, Attorney General from the state of California. Quote, she said, I am honored to even be mentioned, but intend to continue my work for the people of California as Attorney General. I think that these people are publicly saying that they're not going to do it because they haven't been asked. If they had, of course, they would all say, would love the opportunity if I'm chosen. I think the successor is already in the works. President Obama and Eric Holder know who they want to succeed him at the Department of Justice. They already know. And so the people who aren't going to get the role, in effect, they're trying to quell themselves, soften the political blow, if you will. Catherine Ruemmler departed the White House counsel last year. Obama told the New York Times that he deeply valued her smarts and her judgment and her wit. Starting the principal associate deputy attorney general, she was a third-ranking position at the United States Justice Department. Preet Bharara, U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. If you remember, he was huge for his involvement regarding the Bernie Madoff scandal and Osama bin Laden's son-in-law. Down an insider training to simply prosecute a string of cases, primarily in New York. A lot of the cases of corruption in Albany, New York, in the state senate and state assembly, can be attributed to Preet Bharara and his staff. Up next, Loretta Lynch, U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York. She's the top federal prosecutor for Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, and Nassau and Suffolk counties on Long Island. Her office led the investigation into Representative Michael Graham in New York, Republican, resulting in tax evasion and other charges. She also served as U.S. attorney from 1991 and 2001 in the Clinton administration. Amy Klobuchar, senior senator from Minnesota, a senator, United States senator from Minnesota. Easier time getting confirmed, of course, because she's in that body already. Before she was elected to the Senate in 2006, Klobuchar was the Hennepin County attorney. Haven't served on a national scale, but United States senator is good enough. Janet Napolitano, former House Homeland Security Secretary and Governor, was Arizona's Attorney General from 1999 to 2002. She currently serves as the President of the University of California system. Will she want to come back into government and leave California? I don't know. But in any event, does it matter, quite frankly, who is succeeding Eric Holder as Attorney General? The resignation serves as a potential reset for the administration, but they will still need to face the same challenges. Not as if you have a new person, you have new issues. They will be fighting the same tackle. So this announcement and its successor will have the same problems. What are those problems? The inability to push through all of those policies could be complicated if Republicans take control of the Senate in November. Of course, you can't do anything if you don't have the vote. So with all of these people, that decision for his successor is just to be made in a matter of days or weeks. They won't have to face the confirmation process until months later. But as you know, something can always happen in the world of politics. So what will he inherit, the successor? The standoff between the Obama administration and Congress over what to do with more than 100 prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Some of Eric Holder's chief nemesis in Congress, General Isaac in California, Thursday called him, quote, the most divisive U.S. Attorney General in modern history. Pretty tough language. Mr. Isaac chaired the committee that was still locked in a lawsuit with the Justice Department over the documents related to the Mexican gun-running probe, the hacking or the release of phone records to journalists, is quite a belief. And, quote, by needlessly injecting politics into law enforcement, and Eric Holder's legacy has eroded more confidence in legalism than any other general before him. That's from General Isaac, California, Republican Congressman. Now, Boston College law professor that day about Holder's legacy. Quote, broad presidential authority to deal with what is essentially a wartime situation. At a time when the president's legal advisors supported and justified his extraordinary assertion of executive power, end quote. Doesn't sound so flattering. Of course, he's going to make recommendations about the use of the death penalty. And for some reason, every time these people leave office, they gain a whole new set of faults. Their cojones increase as soon as they're out the door. Once they're in office, they'd be able to say a word. They announce that they're leaving, and now they have a litany of recommendations to be made. Those debates over surveillance and terrorism are likely to be raging long after Holder is gone. That's not going to change. And it's not going to go away. There's not going to be a new secretary, a new president, and a new attorney general with all new issues. They'll be facing the same issues. Important to note that Mr. Holder's time got off to a rocky start when he called America, quote, a nation of cowards, for its aversion to talking about racial issues, remarks that caused the consternation of the White House. And so it's going to be very important to see who was chosen, how that successor manages these issues, and how it all proceeds into the final term, President Barack Obama. As the president mentioned, he's married to Dr. Sharon Malone, an obstetrician. They have three children. Malone's sister was Vivian Malone Jones, famous for her part in the stand in the schoolhouse door, which led to the integration of the University of Alabama. Holder has been involved with various mentoring programs, avid baseball fan, and the uncle of former NBA star Jeff Malone. Now, what is the stand in the schoolhouse door? Thank you for asking. Took place at Foster Auditorium, the University of Alabama, in 1963. George Wallace, the governor of Alabama, symbolically attempted to keep his noble promise of segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. And signs of desegregation of schools stood at the door of the auditorium and tried to block the entry of two black students, Vivian Malone Jones and James Hood, the incident and brought George Wallace into the national spotlight, accused as a racist. In 1954, the Supreme Court handed down its decision regarding that case. Brown goes to the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. And was the plaintiff charged with the education of black children in separate public schools from their white counterparts. You might remember that case. Brown versus Board of Education. Of course you did. 1954, May 17th, 2 days after my birthday. So it's good to know the historical context by which all of this framework is made. But it's important to know. That's why we keep saying at the Gifts of Freedom, we want you to hear this. In order to know where you're going, you have to know where you've been. It is so true, so true, so true. So as you reflect on Eric Holder's legacy, whatever it may be to you, please keep us in mind that the Gifts of Freedom, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. History is always important. And you will always be the one who steers your own ship. This was a special report brought to you by the Gifts of Freedom. I'm your host, Roy Paul, the resignation of Eric Holder. Thank you.